that name. He sent me an email.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to a October 28th segment from the Kentucky Water Fuel Museum. With us tonight is a young man who has very generously shared his prototype hydrogen booster via Yahoo chat groups such as Watercar and Hydroxy. This booster unit is known as SMAX Booster. And with us tonight is the young man who is known as Electric Ride on these groups. Hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing just fine. We're very happy to have you with us tonight.
It's good to be here.
Great. Well, as usual, we'd like to find out something about your background and how you got interested in this technology, in alternative energy in general, and what led you to the design of this device, and just how efficiently does it perform? What kind of results has it produced for people who've replicated it? How many people have replicated it? All these questions are things we'd like to find out. So start with your background.
Go ahead.
Yeah, what about, how old are you?
I'm 37.
Okay, 37. So you're not quite as young as I thought.
No, I'm getting there.
Okay, I guess you could say 37 is middle-aged. Huh? Now, what about your early interest in alternative energy? How did that begin?
Well, when I was a kid, like 16, 17, 18 years old, I used to fantasize about having a car that would run on something other than gasoline, you know, kind of your typical, you know, high school, you know, geek kind of engineer kind of fantasy. I used to, you know, talk to my friends about, hey, I wonder if you get a car to run on water. And back in those days, I was thinking like literally filling a gas tank full of water and having water go through a carburetor and run it, you know, a typical V8. Of course, it's not exactly what we're trying to do now, but that's kind of where the seed, you know, began in my mind as to trying to figure out something different, you know, than what we were conventionally using in those days. So,
very good. So how did that then develop, or what did you do from that point on?
Well, my junior year in high school, in chemistry class, our professor had us, our teacher had us do an electrolysis experiment with 120 volts AC. It was basically a simple electrolysis experiment, and we captured the hydrogen and the oxygen off of each electrode into soda bottles, and we'd ignite them. We actually tried to make like a rocket out of the gases that were produced, and so that kind of turned me on to the thought that there was power in water, that when you disassociate it, it actually contained energy that could be used. And we were actually able to shoot one of our small little rockets up about 200 feet in the air with the gases that we created with electrolysis. So that kind of really got me interested in, you know, maybe having the further potential of using it as some kind of an energy source. So
Walmart was actually selling a rocket that had an electrolysis unit.
Never seen it, but I have heard that such a such a toy or whatever did exist or does exist, so I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it is. Okay, so what happened after that then? Did you?
I joined the Navy.
Okay.
I joined the Navy, and I signed up as a nuke machinist mate, and went through the nuke prototype school and learned about steam propulsion and the energies contained within steam. And the Q equations associated with it, and that got me kind of more thinking about how water in its various forms contains a lot more energy, you know, than I had realized in the past, that there's heat and there's enthalpy and entropy, and it just got me thinking more about, you know, kind of, man, there's a lot to water, especially when you start changing phases and whatnot. And once I got stationed on the submarine, I actually saw and did a little training on an onboard electrolysis unit that produced oxygen for our breathing. So, you know, it's a self-contained system where we can remain submerged for extended periods of time, creating, our own breathable air. So.
And what were they doing with the hydrogen? Off-gassing it?
I, you know, It's been a long time, many years, but I think that it was being vented. But I'm not 100% sure, but it's been so many years, I don't remember exactly what was
so
done.
So now you're looking to do the opposite and use the hydrogen.
Yeah.
Who cares?
Looking to do, yes, exactly. But I think it was vented. I don't think that it was stored or utilized. It's been years now. It escapes my memory as to what happened to hydrogen, but I know the oxygen was used for breathing and other things. So.
Yeah, but isn't that great? Because other chemical processes used to extract some valuable element many times produce an undesirable byproduct.
Right.
And in this case, if you're only needing one of the two gases that comes from water, you're not producing anything toxic or harmful to the environment.
That's right. That all you're really producing out of there, besides the gases, since you're using seawater, you get some brine, but that can be easily removed from the system.
Mm-hmm.
So, I took a lot of interest, kind of a curious interest in that too, because I remembered back to my high school experiments. And I'm like, hey, I know a little bit something about that. So those are all kind of the seeds that kind of captured my interest and maintained that throughout, my early 20s. And basically what really turned me on to using it as a fuel was an email that I got from my father. It was completely unrelated, but on the bottom, you know how they do those ads?
Yeah.
Where you get these little links or whatever at the bottom of the Yahoo emails. This particular email had a link to some alternative energy site. I think it was a GM website or something, and I clicked on it, and it was talking about using hydrogen as a fuel, and I kind of got real curious about it, and I did some Google searching, and that's when I hit pay dirt. All these websites, popped up talking about using hydrogen and oxygen as a fuel, and doing more research and reading, and just. I spent probably 3 or 4 months just reading and going to different websites and learning. And then I joined some of the groups a few months later and, read the postings in the groups and heard what people were doing and looked at people's pictures and whatnot. And I started building. That's when I started building my own devices.
Okay, now when was this?
This is in the past, it was probably... This is recent, like a year, when I started actually building something with the intent of creating a fuel for an engine.
Okay.
So it's very recent.
So you actually had quite a long period in between.
Yeah. This.
First
yeah.
Curious about it, and when you then started.
Yeah, like I said, it was something that was always in the back of my mind germinating, and it's like I was, I was just primed for it for the right time, the right information, the right and me being in the. Right frame of mind, having enough time to be able to experiment. I had, quite a bit of time because of my, I worked as a job that afforded me like 3 or 4 days off a week. So
wow.
I had time to play around with experiments and stuff when I wasn't working. So
yeah, it appears to me that there are four factors that come together for a person to be able to do something about a technology like this. You have to have... First of all, as you said, the time, because if you're so busy making a living that you don't have any spare time.
You've got to make time for this
stuff.
Come
home so tired you can't even do anything.
Yep. Hours and hours.
Family responsibilities.
I spent hours and hours and hours every day, every single day, day after day after day, reading and building. And
it was like an obsession.
Yes, it was an obsession,
well,
totally.
Well, it's funny to hear your experience because it reminds me of my own and many other people. And there are just a whole load of people who have come on board just recently in the past year or two.
Yeah.
And it's a coming together of circumstances such as high cost of fuel.
That's the main catalyst
the person
right there.
Really hurting. The pain level brings them to the realization that they've got to find something.
Yep.
And then the fact that they feel like they're getting ripped off. So there's actually
yeah.
a little bit of...
And having family members over in Iraq fighting for oil, it just there's a lot of factors that come together. And I tell you, once it grabs you, the passion for it grabs you. It is an obsession. I mean, once it got a hold of me and I realized there was something to it, I just I couldn't turn away from it.
Yeah.
All I thought about all day long.
Well, then you realize too that your efforts are really ultimately. They're directed at the people who are the most powerful people on Earth. So in a sense, it's like you're trying to push Humpty Dumpty off the wall.
Yeah.
You know, because the energy crowd is the most important group of people on this planet. They make the
tired
most
of bowing down to the man. You know, you got to take
yeah, exactly.
You got to take some of the power into your own hands. And the thing is that water. The thing about water, it's such a perfect fuel because when you disassociate it, it's in the perfect stoichiometric ratio, you know, and there's no harmful byproducts by its combustion. And it falls from the sky. It flows in rivers. It's in lakes and streams and the ocean. I mean, 70% of the earth is covered by this stuff. Water is everywhere.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you don't have to dig for it normally. I mean, if you're out in the desert, yeah, it's a little hard to come by, but, you know.
In this area, they're leveling mountains so that we can generate electricity.
Right.
You know, they're taking
exactly.
the mountains in what's called mountaintop removal.
It's crazy. It's much more easy to, truck in, you know, tankers with water on them than to level mountains and, you know, dig out valleys and whatnot.
Yeah,
so
that's
just
a good point. That
you know,
take Atlanta, for instance. Atlanta, 3 million people, is seriously short on water. I don't know whether these recent rains have helped them or not, but that would be a place where not many people would want to spare water for fuel.
Well, you know, the thing is that that a lot of people don't see is you can use water in its various states of purity. You can make distilled water. It's not that, you know, making perfectly pure water isn't that hard, you know. So even if the availability, I mean, when you talk about water shortages, you're usually talking about drinking water.
Yeah, and we're
water that people
very
can
wasteful
consume.
In a shortage scenario.
You can disassociate, you can purify and disassociate seawater.
Yeah, or sewage. For
you
that.
Know, or even sewage. I mean,
yeah,
exactly. So it doesn't have to be drinking water. It can be any kind of water you can get your hands on, as long as you can filter it and boil it and capture the steam and condense it and distill it, you know, and all these processes can be done. It takes some initiative. It takes time, like we discussed, and it takes money, too. But it's possible. It's possible. Here's the thing. You and I don't know about you, but as far as I am concerned, I do not possess the capability of refining my own gasoline. I don't have the resources, I don't have the knowledge, I don't have the money, I don't have the equipment. But right now, today, I can disassociate water and get fuel.
Yeah.
I'm doing it on my motorcycle. Yeah. Every time I hop on my bike, I am producing my own fuel. You know, and I can't say that about gasoline. So
that really is quite an accomplishment, isn't it?
Well, you know, that's what gives the energy conglomerate so much power, is because they hold all the cards.
Yes.
And it's really an unfair advantage because they call all the shots. And my whole thing on this, my whole take on this is, it's since energy is so important, it's, like you said, is possibly one of the most important resources that we use. We need to take control of that situation. And we need to call our own shots, because this whole, you know, the universe is full of energy. It should be free. It flows in and around us, through us, over us, under us. You know, more energy than we can possibly comprehend. You know, our own bodies possess enough energy within it, our atomic structures, to light up a city of any size for over a week. And most people don't realize.
That's interesting.
How much energy surrounds us. It's untapped. It's unused. It's, you know, the zero-point energy field. It's and I believe that people like Stan Myers and Bob Boyce with their custom electronics have found a way to tap into that zero-point energy field to get more out than they put in, so to speak. It seems like you're getting more out than you put in, but all you're really doing is redirecting the flow and channeling it and focusing it into one area. You're not creating energy. You're tapping into vast, infinite amount of energy that's flowing all around us.
Well, and then there's another approach altogether that involves the use of very little energy. It doesn't appear to be appealing to the zero point or ether or whatever you want to call it, but rather that it has to do with the oddity of the strong nuclear bond of an atom being compromised or weakened by for instance, a water molecule being decomposed, but into a diatomic state.
Right.
And so there's a French scientist who has who noticed this actually in living organisms, that there was, I guess, what you call transmutation taking place. There were certain changes in the between the intake of the organism and the output of chemicals.
Right.
And so he figured that biologically it is possible to create a different element.
Well, here's a take that I have on it, and I'm not saying that this is fact or that I know for sure, but kind of my gut feeling of what's going on with some of the these processes that seem to have more energy out than you're putting in, especially when it comes to water, is that there is, like I was discussing before about the energy within the atoms of our own body. The same applies for water, well, since we're mostly made up of water anyway.
Yeah.
But there is energy locked within the atom of that make up the water molecule. And that energy was put there when those atoms were created, during the creation process. And my thought process on this is that somehow during the recombination of hydrogen and oxygen to form water, that... that the energy that's within those atoms is released. When you think of Stan Meyer's system, where he uses light, LED light, I guess, a laser light, to help with the dissociation process.
Photons.
Yes, I'm thinking that somehow that process taps into the energy that's locked within the atomic structure of the oxygen hydrogen atoms.
Well, apparently so.
And that's where the extra energy is coming from, or the supposed extra energy. And the reason what leads me to that thought process is thinking about nuclear energy. You know, back to nuke subs. I mean, you know, you have this small hunk, you know, of uranium fuel, and in itself it doesn't look like much. It's small, but when you expose it to the proper, atomic reaction, and you get this chain reaction going on, and vast amounts of energy are released, much more than it took to mine it and to purify it and all that stuff. You know, it's much more energy is released, and that energy comes from within the atoms that make up that particular element. So... my thought is that that's the same kind of process that's happening with this recombination of hydrogen and oxygen. Somehow it's a nuclear, not, I want to be careful how I say it, because it's not a nuclear reaction.
Well, you can make a non-radioactive atomic reaction, I suppose.
It's some kind, I want to be careful about the terms, because now people are going to be going, oh, he thinks it's an atomic reaction. It's not. That's not what I think it is.
Well,
but somehow it's tapping into the same kind of energy, the energy that was put there when those elements were created. So
yeah,
that's kind of my take on that.
That's probably true. In fact, I think it was Meyer who suggested or who stated that you cannot condense the exhaust vapor and re-electrolyze it.
Doesn't have as much energy.
No, it has to be exposed to light.
Right,
it
has to be exposed to light. You have to add
energy.
You have to add that energy back. That's what the laser concept was all about. You have to put energy back into the system.
Yeah, so that's not something that academia is talking about. If they are, I don't know where they are.
Yeah.
Really, there's a lot of unknowns in that.
A lot of.
Like you say, when you're in high school, they may show you a simple electrolysis experiment, but the problem is it doesn't go beyond that.
That's the thing. It never went beyond that.
There should be whole classes involved.
There should be.
Just water science.
Yeah. Speaking of classes, I want to kind of go back to or focus a little bit on my design, and I want to give proper recognition to the individuals that helped me come up with this design, because this design didn't come up with it completely entirely on my own. What I did was I combined many concepts from many different knowledgeable people and kind of tried to design a system that was cheap and effective. It was kind of a compromise between, it's kind of a compromise with efficiency and cost and space.
Okay, now, for the sake of those who don't even know what we're talking about, why don't we just briefly describe what the unit is?
All right.
What does it look like?
What the unit is it's a series of stainless steel plates, electrically connected, submerged in electrolyte, that when a voltage is applied, splits water into hydrogen and oxygen, which is fed into the intake of an engine to augment fuel going into the motor, basically replacing gasoline with hydrogen and oxygen.
Okay. Now, the chamber that you're using is a water filter, is that correct?
No, it's the you mean the tube that I'm using? It's just it's a section of PVC pipe that you can get at Home Depot.
So you're using standard white PVC plumbing pipe?
White or black, yeah.
And what size?
Well, it depends on the size of the motor that you're putting it on. Oh. I have a 4-inch design, I have a 3-inch design, which is on my motorcycle, and a 2-inch design for, like, lawnmowers and stuff.
Okay, so anywhere from 2 to 4-inch PVC.
It could be as big as you want. That's the thing. It doesn't have to be any specific size. I chose 4 inches because most engine compartments can accommodate a 4-inch diameter, 1-foot-long tube somewhere in there.
Right. And so
anything bigger than
chamber,
that,
the less often you have to add electrolyte, I guess.
Right. Well, and any bigger than that, and you start running into space problems.
Right.
And that was one of the considerations. See, I was trying to make something that could work, that was an easy retrofit, that could work on most vehicles.
And that's great.
So, yeah. And I wanted it to be something that was easily replicated and cheap to make. So.
Okay. So you're taking a piece of 4-inch PVC, for example. You're putting a cap on the bottom of it.
Yeah, you cap the bottom and
mounting it vertically in the engine compartment.
Yep, mount it vertically
and
cap the top and put a gas outlet valve on the top. Basically.
Okay, so you're putting the same kind of cap on the top as you put on the bottom, or no?
No. If you look at the design, which is posted on some of the chat groups.
Okay,
the,
maybe we can mention that it's posted.
Yeah,
for instance,
it is.
Water
it's
car.
Posted as a Smax Booster and the like the Yahoo Water Group and Water for Fuel and Hydroxy.
So if a person just subscribes to one of these groups, they can then
click they can go
the
in
files
into files
section, right?
Right. Yep.
And go to Smax Booster, and there's a complete description. Did Patrick Kelly do a description of your device?
He helped develop the document that's in there.
Okay, very good.
So it's very it's pretty basic as far as basic concept of how it works, and it has the parts and materials breakdown, and even the part numbers and where to get the parts.
Let's discuss some of those parts, like your plates, for instance. You were using stainless steel switch plate covers,
right? Right. Yeah, and the design is still as posted. That's still what's in there.
Okay.
I've gone on to other materials because the Smack Booster is only a stepping stone. I want to make that real clear. It's not designed to be the end-all of end-alls. I've got people saying, well, I'd like to hook up 12 of these things and run my motor on just hydroxy. That's not what it was built for. Each booster requires 20 amps. So if you want to take 10 of these things and hook them up, you're going to need 200 amps. Do the math. You can't run 20 amps to 10 boosters and expect each one to put out 1.7 liters
okay.
per minute.
So let's do the math, though, and talk about why it is that a single booster drawing 20 amps will actually increase the miles per gallon on a vehicle.
Because you're adding an extra fuel. You're adding fuel to the system that's not gasoline. So basically what you're doing is substituting. You're substituting the amount of gasoline take the amount of energy of gasoline that would normally be used, substituting it with this hydroxy mix. That's where the savings comes in. You're substituting one fuel for another. So that you're
saving money because this fuel is able to be produced without using that gasoline up.
Right. You're taking the amount of gasoline that would normally be burnt for the same amount of power, and you're replacing it with the hydroxy gas that is produced from electrolysis.
And so some people will say, well, it's not possible to take that amount of gasoline out of the system and produce more combustible fuel from water. They say that violates laws of physics and so on.
They can say it all they want, but the proof is in the pudding.
In other words,
and I've got a unit that makes increases gas mileage by 20%, and that's people can, physicists and chemists can say all they want, but when you drive back and forth to work with a 20% fuel savings, that the proof is in the pudding.
Okay, so let's take, for instance, your motorcycle. You say you've created a smaller sized unit for it.
It's a 3-inch version, yep, but it's the same design, just a smaller.
And using how many plates?
Same amount of plates. It's the same design that's posted. It's, 16 plates.
Okay.
And it's just in a cut-down version.
And these are switch plates?
Yeah, no, they're not switch plates. I actually use stainless steel shim stock.
Okay.
But you could use switch plates. I chose the shim stock just because of the smaller diameter. It was easier to fabricate.
Okay, but again, going with plates that are about the size of those switch plates?
They're approximately the same size. They're a little smaller. The reason for the switch plates and the 4-inch diameter PVC is because those 16 plates will fit inside a 4-inch PVC container without having to cut them or modify them.
Now, why 16? Normally, when people think about electrolysis and, say, in a 12-volt system in a vehicle, you would tend to think that you would want a number of plates that corresponds to about...
Right, that divides the voltage.
Yes.
Well, here's the thing. Space was the number one consideration. I wanted to make sure whatever I built fit inside that 4-inch PVC. So I was limited to how many plates I could use. The second thing you got to remember is this is a center-tapped design, which means one of the power leads goes to the outside of the plates and another one goes to the center of the plates. So when I say 16 plates, actually dividing that in half, there's actually 8 plates per side.
Right.
However...
In other words, you have the positive lead goes to both outside plates?
Right.
And then the negative goes smack dab in the middle.
Right, and I've switched. I've tried negative in the middle and positive in the middle. I haven't really observed a difference in output as far as which whether the center is positive or negative. It's pretty much the same output for either configuration.
And so the plates that are in between those electrically charged plates are not connected.
They are not connected to the power source.
So you're
calling
them floaters, or
right? They're called floaters, and they receive their voltage from the surrounding electrolyte.
Okay, and yet you see gas bubbles coming off of them.
Oh yes, definitely.
So
each cell area produces gas.
So what was the purpose of putting the floaters in the system? Is this what reduces the amp draw?
No, the purpose of the floaters is to reduce the voltage per cell. Here's the key. One of the key concepts, a little bit of a basic electrolysis here, is that approximately 1.4 volts is required for the dissociation of water. Anything more than 1.4 volts is wasted in heat. It doesn't make the gas. It just makes heat, and basically, you leave it on long enough, you're making steam.
Okay.
So 1.4 volts. So the closer you get to 1.4 volts...
By adding more plates.
By adding more plates, the better you are. Now, if I used a bigger diameter pipe, I could have put more plates in. So instead of... Now, I use eight plates, but two plates makes a cell because of the step gap design. So it's actually only 4 complete cells between the 12 volts, so it's 3 volts per cell. Now, I could have added more plates and dropped that down closer to 1.4. Say, I could have done 2 volts instead of 3 volts, but space was a limiting factor. I didn't want to go above 4 inches in diameter because, like I said, a lot of engine compartments, especially on these modern cars, won't accommodate something much bigger than that. So I made a compromise, a calculated compromise, saying I'm willing to settle for 3 volts per cell in the name of saving space. And so that's basically what I came up with. Because through experimentation, I determined that 3 volts per cell doesn't result in an overheating condition in the entire cell stack.
So is that what you found from not just your replication, but that of others, that people are not experiencing overheating problems like they are with some other manufactured boosters?
That's pretty much what I found on my own. For those that are in have been involved in the groups for a while, they walked along with me through my development process, because I posted everything as I learned things. I first started with using tap water and salt. And then I discovered I learned that using distilled water and KOH results in a clean reaction with no scum whatsoever. And that's something else.
Meaning this typically reddish brown, is that the
Yeah, typically reddish brown, muddish looking, foamy gunk. And what it is it's number one, it's stuff, if you're not using distilled water, it's the sediments that are in the water. Like if you're using tap water or rainwater, which is not pure, or spring water, which is not pure.
So you got minerals and chemicals.
Minerals and chemicals. And then if you're using baking soda or sea salt or rock salt or table salt, you have more compounds that are precipitated out by the use of those chemicals as well. So you end up with this brown, frothy mass of gunk. And also, in there is plate material, your stainless steel plate material, because if you use salts like that, other than KOH or NaOH, you will start to erode the plates. So you have, the compounds coming out of the stainless steel, you've got the precipitates coming out of the water, you've got the byproduct reactions of these salts that you're using. So it all adds up to sometimes green, sometimes red, sometimes brownish looking scum that builds up in the water that has to be flushed out very frequently. And also your plates will have to be replaced very frequently as well.
Okay, so the things to recommend the SMAX booster, even if you have found that there's something perhaps better than the design that's posted now, at least something better than the switch plates or whatever, but the success of the system, even as it was first publicized and recommended, and why a person could still do it with good results, is that you're talking about a low-cost system. And mm-hmm. What is the cost approximately to put one of these together?
I'm selling them for $200 a pop. I will build, anyone that asks, I will build them one for $200. If you decide to go out and do it on your own, it's probably no more than $50 for all the parts.
Okay, and that's really honest of you to tell someone that they
incline. Oh, yeah. When you buy one off me, you're paying for my labor, because you know what? It's labor intensive. It's meticulous. The spacing has to be right. You can't just kind of haphazardly throw one together. It's got to be.
Yeah. What is the spacing?
The spacing is 2 millimeters on the design that I have posted. I'm always playing around with my gap designs and stuff, but 2 millimeters is what I kind of settled with, because it seems to be the spacing. And this is something that I found through my own experimentation, hours and hours of trying different configurations and spacings. It's the spacing that facilitates the release of the bubbles from the plates without having bubble entrapment, and the space requirements that I had. So it was, again, it's a happy medium. It seems like if I go to 1 millimeter spacing, it's a little too close. The plates tend to try to touch if it's not just put together just so. And bubbles tend to, the gas pockets tend to form between them. And once that happens, production rate goes down. And any further apart, like I said, you run into problems fitting the cell stack within the 4-inch diameter. So that was the optimal spacing, and that's basically through trial and error and testing and recording numbers and comparing, that's how that number came to be, 2 millimeters.
Okay.
And I think you'll find the Bob Boyce design, which kind of brought me into that range,
uh-huh.
I think that's 1.5 to 3 millimeter spacing is what he suggests. So I figured that was a pretty good place to start, and I went narrower and I went wider. And you know what? Basically, what I found is what he had already publicly posted. You know, so go with the. That's one thing. Another thing I want to add to is my design was born from a combination of Frank Roberts and Bob Boyce's designs.
Frank Roberts used floater plates?
Frank Roberts did not use floater plates, but what he did is he used a parallel configuration, but he had three groups of parallel plates within the same bath, and that gave me the idea with the step gap design, because Bob is always talking about how imperative it is to keep the cells isolated from one another to prevent current migration or current leakage. And Frank's answer to that problem was to have the cells separated by a distance in the same electrolyte bath. So
that the current will want to go to the next...
Instead of...
Around it.
Yes. So I used those two designs and came up with a step gap design, which is basically... I'm kind of trying to simulate Bob Boyce's isolated cell design
without going to the
with Frank Roberts use the distance. That's where the step gap came in. That's why in the design there's these gaps that seem to be useless that don't produce any gas. Those gaps are inspired by Frank Roberts' configuration in his parallel design.
Very interesting.
So, but I didn't want to use opposing parallel plates because, again, Bob Boyce said that there is an important factor of magnetism going on. You want all the fields to be pointing in the same direction for the maximum gas output. So that's also why I have the center tap design, because it creates, at least when I sat down and analyzed the magnetic fields, it creates kind of a loop of magnetic field within the booster that I'd like to think, I can't necessarily prove it, but I'd like to think that helps augment gas production.
Very interesting.
Because I did try just doing an outside positive and minus configuration.
Follow.
It produced less gas.
Okay.
The configuration that I have is the one that produces the most gas. So
what is the gas production on the...
For 20 amps, 12 volts, it's 1.7 liters per minute of hydroxy, and I do concede that there is some water vapor in there. It's not just pure hydroxy because the cell does heat up over time. It just heats up less than some of the other designs that are out
what
there.
What is the temperature that it reaches?
After several hours mounted to the side of my bike, that unit gets up to about 140 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, which isn't...
Which is
really
it's
thing.
Below boiling. The thing is, I was searching for below boiling point. There's other systems out there, and I'm not going to use the name of them, but some people know what I'm talking about. It reaches 200 degrees.
But there is some advantage in what we would call brute force electrolysis for there to be about 180 degree temperature, isn't it correct?
Yeah, and I think you've talked about this before on the forums, and I've replied to some of your comments on that. The issue I have with running, like they call them steaming behemoths, that make hydroxy gas and water vapor, the issue I have with that is that you have no regulation of the amount of moisture that you're adding to. Some people say, well, it's a known fact that adding water to an ICE will help in the combustion process. But when you attach a steaming behemoth, quote-unquote, booster, you don't know how much steam you're putting in there. You don't know what the dilution is of the system. So you don't really have a lot of control over how much hydroxy versus steam you're making. And here's the thing. If you make too much steam with respect to the amount of hydroxy gas that you're producing, you can actually you neuter the power of the hydroxy gas. You can actually make it so it's pretty much useless.
Yeah.
If there's too much water vapor in there, you are not going to get that nice, crisp combustion in the chambers. It's not going to do anything.
So
it's going to be, you might as well just stick a water boiler on it and just add steam.
Right. But what about this? Have you checked the difference in the gas output of your cell at a higher and a lower temperature?
It remains about the same.
And yet a lot of it's moisture. It
adds a little bit more. When it's cold, I'm running maybe 1.55 or 1.6 liters per minute, and then when it gets up to temperature, it's 1.7.
And so you feel like that is possible?
Some of that's water vapor.
Yeah, water vapor. Okay.
But it's not a whole lot. So in this case, I think that it may actually be advantageous, like you were kind of saying. It's not so much that it's diluting the power of the hydroxy mix. So that was the key. It's no, like everything else about my design, it is a compromise between,
a happy middle, yeah.
It's a happy middle ground. It's not the most efficient design. There is heat generated. I'm not running at 1.4 volts per cell. I'm running at 3 volts per cell. It's a compromise with space, with cost. The thing is, it's not designed to be a magical, cutting edge.
Yeah.
I built this thing and I designed this thing. It's simply a stepping stone.
Look at it this way.
It's meant to be, and I posted it, it's meant to be a learning tool, but it's a learning tool that you hook up to your car and you start putting money in your wallet.
Exactly.
But it teaches you, if you go out and you build this thing, if you download my document and you build one and you put it on your car, in a year's time, you're going to know 1,000% more about hydroxy production than you knew before you
started. Exactly. So it's a good beginner's project.
That's what it's designed for. And a lot of people have attacked me saying, you're not using isolated design. It's not as efficient. That's true. But that's okay because it's a happy medium. I mean, it's better than not doing anything.
Right. And, we're talking $50. And then the savings in gas can be fairly quickly realized.
Even though it's not the most efficient and, it doesn't have fancy electronics or whatever, you get 20% increase. Every time you go to the pump, you're saving 20%.
Now, have you heard feedback from people who've replicated this and they've confirmed that same percentage of increase in miles per gallon?
Yes, I have had. I have gotten emails directly, personal emails saying, hey, thanks a lot for your design. I built it, and it works like you said it is, and it's, I hooked up to my car, and I'm getting a 22% increase is what one person reported. Another person reported 25. Another person reported 15. So, it varies. The bigger the engine, the less percentage savings you're going to see, obviously.
Because you would have to have a higher gas production.
Yeah, you need more gas production, and people are replicating my 4-inch unit. So, you're not going to get the same savings on a 3.8 liter as you are. You're going to get less savings on a 6.0 liter. You know what I mean? It's relative to the size of the engine. So.
Okay, but it's a low cost unit. It's easy to build, or they can pay you to build it for them if they need it to be done. So.
And the thing I want to stress the most by anybody who's chooses to click on the link and listen to this is if you're going to replicate my system, use distilled water and either potassium hydroxide or NaOH, one of the two. Don't use baking soda. Don't use salt. Don't use tap water. I've got a lot of people talking about how, I built the Smack Booster and, I put baking soda in it. If you make my booster and you put baking soda in it, you do not have a Smack Booster.
Yeah,
you've got a water separator and a steam generator. It's not producing and performing
the way.
Well,
really, it would be good to emphasize this at this time then, that there are many different types of devices that have been patented, that you can go and find a patent on it, you can replicate that. Things that have been mentioned on the groups and in the file sections of the different groups, you can find plenty of plans. And, many times we get the idea, which really you did yourself. You admitted yourself that you took a combination of designs.
Absolutely.
And you morph them into something that turned
out
to be good.
Exactly. That's a good way to put it. It's a metamorphosis of many people's ideas.
Yeah, and so what you're basically saying is that people are going to do that to your device. They already have, and they're using, for instance, baking soda instead of the recommended potassium hydroxide or sodium hydroxide. And you're here to tell them, look, if you're going to do my design, I've already realized that the proper thing to use is distilled water.
Right, because I've tried the other substances,
right,
and they don't work.
So
now,
it isn't to say that in other types of device it might not be usable, but at least in yours, you're letting them know, this is what I've found works.
Yeah,
and
definitely
don't even
won't
bother.
Work.
Don't
it
even
won't
go.
Work. Yeah. And, you know, and here's the thing, is that really that concept applies with electrolysis in general. I don't think you're going to find any configuration of a device that is going to promote the use of something that becomes a part of the reaction. That's the key to this thing. You can't... If you're going to make hydroxy, pure hydrogen and oxygen, you have to use a catalyst that does not become a part of the reaction. Otherwise, you're creating, you may find, okay, say you use baking soda, and you double the output of your design. Well, what is in that output? I mean, you've doubled it, but what's in there? I mean, what gas is it? It's not hydroxy gas anymore. It's something else. You got
exactly.
other, God knows what that's
unless
in
you're
there.
A chemist, how are you going to know?
Yeah, and who knows what effects that's having on your health, on the health of your engine. Is the extra, materials that you're making, maybe they, maybe it buffers the hydroxy, kind of like water does, steam does. Maybe you're not even making a combustible gas anymore.
Yeah. Tell you
who
what,
knows
we
what
have a
mean.
Couple of callers, and I think they're people from the very groups that we've been participating in. How about if we take one?
Sure, that's fine.
Okay, let's see who's on the line here. Hello.
Hello.
Who do we have with us here?
This is Kirk Miller.
Oh, hi, Kirk. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Very good. So you've been listening to the program.
Yes, I have. I didn't catch Electric's name.
That's correct.
Yeah, I've chosen to leave my name out of the forums, and for the reason being is that there's a couple reasons for that. One of the main reasons is in case I'm working on other designs, and if they turn out to work and I, sort of quote-unquote hit it big with a good design, I want to have the chance to be able to post that information and get it out there before something happens. You have all these stories about, like the Paul Zagouras thing and Stanley Myers and all that stuff. I don't want that to happen to me. I want that information to get out there before someone else can get a hold of it.
Well, and we have to respect your particular...
Well, I want to explain... the other thing is, too, is that sometimes things can get kind of nasty on these forums. And, say you could have... Anybody could be out there, any crazy, person who all of a sudden, gets the idea that, they don't like another individual, and, you run the risk of, if you get your personal intimate information out there, you run the risk of compromising your own safety, I can't be a good researcher and make new discoveries and streamline systems if I'm dead or paralyzed or
yeah.
my house is burnt down.
It does help to be alive.
And so those are the reasons I'm not giving out my real name or
well,
my
hey,
location.
As long as you're giving out the technological information you're sharing, that's all we care about anyway.
And I can be reached, I don't keep my email secret, electric1@hotmail.com, so I can always be reached. And
well, that's a good question. What if someone wants to order one of your units?
Yeah, electric1@hotmail.com, shoot me an email, say, hey, listen, I've got, such and such a vehicle or whatever. You don't even have to tell me what vehicle you have. Just tell me that you want a booster built, and I'll get to work.
And
I've
so
had
far,
a couple
no one
people...
on the group has said that you've ripped them off.
What's that?
So far, no one on the group has said that you've ripped them off.
Nobody. I don't have any negative feedback at all.
Okay.
And I've sold, one guy ordered two, because I can make them, I can custom size these things. And this one guy had a Mercedes, I think it was an SL, and it didn't have a lot of room, not enough room to fit. The poster design is it's almost a foot long, and he didn't have that kind of room. So he wanted 2 6-inch units, which was a challenge because the plates just barely fit in a 6-inch long tube. But that's what he wanted. you know, and he wanted two of them. And so I built them for him to his specs and sent them off, and he was very happy. So, you know, I can do some custom.
Was that a diesel or was that a gasoline application?
What's that?
Was that a diesel or a gasoline?
It was gasoline, SL. Yeah. SL, I don't know if
it was. Has anyone used your device on a diesel?
I am not aware of anybody, but that doesn't mean nobody has. I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that are replicating the design and using it. You know, not everybody's going to say, hey, I built your thing, you know. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty of people out there. It could be used on a diesel. I've never tested it on one, but I don't see any reason why there couldn't be. But I am glad you brought up the diesel topic, because there is one thing that I want to make very clear as a danger warning. Do not, despite other advice that people may have heard, do not add hydroxy before the inlet of a turbo to be pressurized within the intake tubing and perhaps an intercooler. And in the manifold, that is a very large volume of pressurized, flammable gas, posing a huge potential, you know, physical and mechanical problem for the user.
Yeah, of course, that would be assuming that you did have the necessary concentration of hydroxy too. I think it has to be the minimum would be like. What is it, 4%?
I tell you what, I don't want to find out.
In other words, don't
what
even
the
try.
Percentage is.
Yeah.
The best rule of thumb is to have as little volume of hydroxy gas on your vehicle as possible at all times. You know, as little volume as possible. Don't store it. Don't have it, you know, compressed and under large volume. You try to get it as close to the butterfly valve as you can possibly get it. Because, you know, like I said, you're riding around with a big bomb otherwise, because
okay, well,
it has its own oxides.
Kirk, you got a question you'd like to ask her?
Well, first I have a comment, and then I do have a question. My comment is that by pulsing, I was using 14 amps with straight DC, and then I put a square wave on it, and my square wave was able to go from anywhere from 4 kilohertz up to 200 kilohertz. And the DC consumption, the current draw went down to 5.1 amps with, it looked like, the same gas production.
That sounds right.
Was that on a max booster?
No, this was on a 2x8 flat plate stainless.
But yeah, that's basically the purpose of a PWM, is to reduce the current draw for the same amount of gas output. So
from my comment is that I've been studying energy devices for many years, and Tom Bearden, I don't know if anyone out there has studied his work, but he's got what's called a motionless electromagnetic generator. Okay?
Yeah, I've read about that.
You can look it up. But it occurred to me that an automobile engine has that very device in it, which I took my antique car, and I went out and I measured the amp draw on the coil. And at idle, I was pulling 2 amps. And then as the speed of the engine went up, and of course you're putting out more spark energy, the consumption out of the coil went down. And it went down to 1 amp at 3,000 RPM.
Probably so, due to the pulsing magnetic field, I would
exactly.
imagine.
Exactly. The collapsing magnetic field.
Yeah, there's something to be said for that.
Ways, yes, and that's exactly what the inductors and Stan Myers system are doing.
Well, I'll tell you, the next development in the SMAC booster, which I haven't had a chance, I've been kind of derailed on other projects, and I'm just barely kind of getting refocused on alternative energy projects that I've been working on. But the next phase, before I kind of walk away from the SMAC booster design and move on to more complicated designs, is I purchased a PWM from the Hydrogen Garage. Bro Andrew, he's a great guy. But I purchased one of those PWMs, and I want to modify it so that it can put between, say, 20 and 60 kilohertz, so I can have a range to play in, and I want to see what happens to my design when I pulse.
Well, Kirk would like one of those bigger things if you can make two of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I varied the pulse all the way from 4 kilohertz up to 200 kilohertz. And I noticed no difference in gas production at
but
any
a significant reduction in current, right?
It went down by half. And
so here's the thing.
All frequencies.
Here's the thing. if we can use a PWM to drop the current for the same gas output, my thought is once we get the current down to a minimum level, add more electrolyte to raise the current back up, and that theoretically should hopefully make more gas. You follow my thought process on this?
That's what the MEG is all about, the motionless electromagnetic generator.
Right.
You could have 10 of those things under your hood and draw very little current.
Right. So that is something.
What it does is goes over unity, and it's been replicated.
Right.
What's that called again, Kurt?
It's the motionless
electromagnetic
generator. Yes. Yes.
Well,
it's been replicated on J.L. Naden, and there are designs for it around. But that's what we're doing with the water cell and with pulsing the current.
I would like to see somebody, if I don't get to it first, I would like to, and it wouldn't be bad to have a replication of the same experiment, somebody to hook up PWM on my cell at the proper, you got to have the proper range of frequency. It's got to be high enough. It's got to be in the kilohertz range.
Yes.
And I would like to see what happens to the output of my design when it's hit with a pulse, preferably a nice sharp square wave. Something that I've learned in my research is that just put in a sine wave to the electrolyte, to the water molecule, isn't good enough. It's got to be a nice sharp, as sharp as you can get it, square wave,
which
pulsing.
You can purchase that circuit online now.
Oh, really?
Isn't that what your PWM from Hydrogen Garage is? Isn't it a square wave?
Yes, I don't, but there is the Dave Lawton replication is available online. I have a link for it, which I'll give you if you like. But my question, before we get too far away from it, is that how do you measure gas output?
Oh, yeah, that's simple. The gas output, I use the inverted bottle method. It's one of the oldest tricks in the book. I take a non-variable volume, such as a glass bottle. I fill it with water and submerge it and turn it upside down so that it's basically, when you pull it up to the water line, it's full of water from top to bottom. And I take the output hose of my cell, and I get it going, I get heated up and whatnot, and I stick it into the bottle, and I start my watch. The minute I stick the hose in the mouth of the bottle, I hit the stopwatch. And I time how long it takes to empty that bottle out.
No back pressure on it?
What I do is I hold the bottle so that the water level is always level with the container.
Mm-hmm.
Follow what I'm saying? So that there's no vacuum or pressure inside.
Yep.
I keep the water level constant. I raise the bottle up as it displaces the water. So that's not a factor in my measurement. And I know it's a given volume, the bottle, how much it holds, and that's how I did my calculations. And they're fairly accurate.
Have just about a minute left, and I've got another call.
I will sign off then, James.
Okay.
Hey, it was nice talking to you.
Thanks for calling.
Nice talking to you.
Okay. All right, take it easy. Bye.
Let's see who we have with us now. Hello.
Hi, Electric, James.
Oh, there you go.
James, how's it going?
Hi, Larry Jarboe. How are you doing, Larry?
Oh, Larry. Hey, how's it going, buddy?
Oh, just fine. We got a short time, but let's talk a little safety. I missed the front part of the show. Did you mention about how important it is to add a bubbler to the system?
We did not talk about that.
We did not talk about that, but our conversation was leading to that. I was talking about not having large volumes of hydroxy on board at any given time.
Well, let's emphasize the bubbler for the listeners.
Yes, let's emphasize the bubbler, because you absolutely must have some kind of device that prevents accidental backfire into the cell device, or you will have a catastrophic explosion on your hands.
So that's assuming that the cell has a space of gas storage in the upper portion of it.
Well, there'll be gas. If you're making gas, even if the water level is right at the top of the bubbler of the cell, which it shouldn't be, but even if it was, you're still going to have gas in the tube leading to the engine, and the manifold is going to be full of gas as well. So there is a potential path for the very fast hydroxy flame front to travel back right to the cell and cause damage.
So, for instance, in the system you have on your motorcycle, you have a bubbler installed?
Yeah, I've got an integrated, it's not really necessarily integrated, but it's, pictures of it are in the photos group, where I do have a bubbler mounted to the side of it, and the gas has to percolate through it in order to get to the engine. And that's, like I said, in case of a backfire, because as you disassociate the water and the water level drops, the gas volume on top of the cell increases. So the potential for catastrophe also increases. The more gas you have on board, the more chance you have for a damaging explosion.
Yeah, and of course we have to mention the fact that the bubbler itself is susceptible to blowing up if the same situation obtains in it.
That's why my bubbler is designed with a pop-off feature, so that the bubbler, it can't be completely full of water, otherwise you'll percolate water into the engine. So there has to be some volume there of hydroxy gas, and it will blow. And I just designed it with an easy pop-off top, so if it blows, the pop tops off, and you get a little water, and that's it. And it doesn't destroy your cell, you know, the generator container. And you just put the top back on and, you know, keep going, basically.
Okay. So you gotta...
But, yeah, and those flashback arrestors, check valves and the arrestors for acetylene torches, they're not good enough.
Yeah, because of the faster flame speed.
Yeah, hydroxy is hydrogen and oxygen. It burns way faster than those devices can catch it.
Right. Anything
and they're basically
else,
useless.
Anything else you'd like to say while you're with us? Or?
Well, the other thing, we're starting to run out of time, so I know it's tight. Also, the idea of a bubbler is you keep your caustic fluids out of your engine. KOH, NaOH.
You're scrubbing those.
Yep,
exactly.
Because it does, and that's a point to mention also, that yes, some of the electrolytic material does escape the cell just from suspension in the water, because there is some water vapor coming off of the cell. So you will have some KOH or NaOH, whatever you're using, escaping the cell, and the bubbler does act as a catch-all for that.
So the idea being that you can recycle your bubbler water and turn it into cell water. If you're using distilled water in the bubbler,
yeah, you can do that.
You
can do that. You have to adjust your electrolyte concentration accordingly. Anytime you add water to the cell, you have to check to make sure your concentration is correct by monitoring your current. You may have to add some more electrolyte, some more potassium hydroxide.
You haven't been doing that with a pH meter?
No. The purpose of the potassium hydroxide that I use in the cell is to adjust to get, it sets the amount of current that is drawn. I can control how much current I draw by the concentration of the electrolyte in the cell. So I don't use a pH meter, I use an ammeter. And if I'm drawing too much current, I'll add more distilled water. If I'm not drawing enough current, I'll add some more KOH. So,
just by watching the amp draw.
Yeah. Yep, just by watching the amp draw.
Well, our time is up. It's been very enjoyable. And Larry, thanks for joining us.
Well, y'all have a good evening. And,
yeah, thanks for calling, man.
Maybe another follow-up, because there's a lot of information still needs to be told.
Oh, yeah, definitely. We could go on and on and on for hours.
Especially your hydrogen on-demand hybrid project. I think.
Oh, yeah, my H2 EVR. Yeah, I'm working on that. That's a project in the makings, and it's rather slow going. It's very expensive, but this is all going to be top-end stuff. So.
And so this is an electric vehicle with a...
Yeah, it's
hydroxy power generator on board.
Yes, it's definitely want to at least talk about it for 1 or 2 minutes. It's an EV conversion with a genset on board that will be charging the batteries to run the electric motor. Basically, what the concept is. So, in a roundabout way, it's a water car. It's a car that will run on water, just not the way not the conventional way of, pumping hydroxy into an ICE, because reciprocating motors they're not very efficient, and an electric motor is way more efficient, and it's instant on-demand torque, less moving parts, quieter, it's just, less heat generators, it's just a more efficient system altogether. I think it's the way to go. It's the way of the future, and definitely, I'm set on that. I'm I'm positive that's the way to go.
It looks like it's coming down the pike, even from the automakers, at least in the
yeah, with all these hybrids. You know what? With the hybrid, that's what it is. I mean, it's the same concept. They're going about it a roundabout way. They're not taking full advantage of the electric motor aspect of it. But that's where it's leaning.
You know what's interesting? I was just listening to a Clive Cussler book on tape. I don't know if you've ever read any of his books, but a recent book, I guess last year by him, and he was the scenario was that there was a terrorist group that was attacking this guy because he was trying to promote these halfway solutions to the world's energy problems. And this group was saying, look, your products are not the answer, just like you were just saying about the high, they don't go all the way.
Yeah, yeah, they're teasers.
Yeah.
It's like the EV1. What a great idea. And then they pull it. It was too good. It was ahead of its time.
Exactly. So
GM was like, whoops, everybody's going to want to go electric, man, we got to stop this.
Yeah, they want partial solutions that still involve the
yep.
fossil fuel.
They destroyed all those cars, perfectly good cars. They were quick.
Well, here you are going about your work, and Larry as well, Kirk, people all over the world are doing this, and everyone's just doing a great job sharing information, offering free plans for a $50 build-it-yourself or offering to build it for them for $200. This is the kind of thing that's going
to... The way to go.
Yeah, it's going to get the technology into the public consciousness, and it's going to produce some more news media documentation. They can't forever ignore it if people are doing it all over the place.
That's right.
So.
Especially if the kids find out, which they are.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, and you're a kid,
Yeah, at heart.
Is really still a kid, yeah. So, hey, well, listen, thanks to both of you, and thanks for everyone else tuning in, and we'll have to do a follow-up on this to catch up.
Yeah, definitely. It's great. I appreciate you giving us the opportunity.
Okay, well, everybody take care and have a good evening.
Bye, guys. All right, bye.